I made sure the stairway door from the third floor to the fourth was locked. It wasn't when I showed it to Roscoe. Hey, folks, how are you? Keith Tyler, your volunteer broadcaster, bringing you the Mystery Hour right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine and O.W. Hammond bring us our first story. It's called A Problem at the Villa. Scott McKinney called me himself. One of the guests had taken a tumble. Since Manus McKinney, Scott's father, had converted their villa and its 20 private acres on the Gulf of Mexico from a tax and maintenance nightmare to a resort, a destination, 3 guests had died. Men in their 80s, coronaries, well, this time it was a woman, young, 40s, Scott thought. Royal Palms lined the access road from the highway to the villa, an extravagant example of Mediterranean architecture officially named the Villa Jamil, pink stucco walls, balconies, terraces, arches, red terracotta roofs. The security gate was down. That's unusual on Sundays, especially late in the afternoon. Probably Sheriff Roscoe had ordered it. I flashed a smile at Lewis, the attendant. He gave my second-hand Miata a hard look and reminded me I didn't work for the county anymore. Guests only, I told him Scott had requested my presence. He raised the gate. I edged the Miata into an empty valet space between a Mercedes and a Bentley. Sheriff Roscoe, my former boss, and his crew were gone. A few guests mingled in the lobby. Scott wore white trousers, a yellow Brooks Brothers shirt, and a blue blazer, his narrow face more gaunt than usual, sad brown eyes. I followed him to his paneled office behind the registration desk. Whiskey if I wanted it. I didn't. His summary was brief and to the point. The guest's name was Michelle Glenn, a resident of Austin, Texas. She signed in 3:40, went to her room on the third floor, then returned to the lobby for the 4 o'clock complimentary champagne. The champagne was Scott's idea to keep the villa's 4-star rating. It was Prosecco, not champagne with a capital C, a way of saving a few bucks. Ms. Glenn drank 1 glass. A woman who had shared a couch with Ms. Glenn said she appeared to be fading a bit. Maybe 20 minutes later, a man photographing the fountain in the back courtyard discovered Ms. Glenn's body in the grass beside the path to the reflecting pool. Scott said, "Well, presumably she left the lobby and went upstairs to her room. Roscoe thinks along the way she took off her shoes, hoisted herself onto the bench on one of the balconies to get a bird's-eye view of the gardens and the gulf. Lost her balance and toppled over the wall." "You disagree? Why was she on the fourth floor, where it's private? When I came down at 3:45, I made sure the stairway door from the third floor to the fourth was locked. It wasn't when I showed it to Roscoe. I remember being up there. Great views." Scott looked surprised. I told him that years ago Lucy, one of his daughters, had invited me. "We discussed writing," I said. "She liked it that a county detective had been an English major and read books. You enjoy being a lawyer now?" "Yeah, lots more free time." "What did Roscoe say about the door?" "Well, he assumes the housekeepers have keys." "They do, but..." "Sundays, do you always make sure the door is locked?" "A couple of times Lucy left it open for her boyfriend, but this weekend he's in Miami. She was in the lobby pampering the guests." Scott poured himself a whiskey. Roscoe had checked Glenn's room and told Scott to keep everyone out, but he gave me a key. Manus had nixed the idea of keycards. No self-service elevator either. I could have used the stairs, but I would have missed the company of Dennis, according to his name tag. He told me Ms. Glenn toted her own luggage. He had carried her to the third floor and down again for wine a few minutes later. After that, he didn't see her again, so she must have used the stairs. The floors are clearly marked. He didn't understand why or how she ended up on four. A Do Not Disturb sign hung on the door. The room was small. Mirrors made it appear larger. Glenn's luggage was one overnight case. Minimum toiletries, a change of clothes. She wasn't there for the heated pool, the spa, or other amenities. A long red feather caught my attention. Going down, Dennis commented that Ms. Glenn wore a blouse, jeans, and shoes like his mother's. Espadrilles, he thought they were called. Except for her silver belt buckle, no jewelry that he could see. Not your usual guest whose baubles could put a kid through Princeton. Kim is blonde and 40. I'm 4 years older. She does research for me, taking charge of billing, updates the office technology, reminds me about appointments, and mixes an excellent vodka martini. She handed me one. Night had settled in. Too breezy and chilly for no-see-ums and mosquitoes. We sat on the patio behind her house, mid-century cracker box in her estimation, but there weren't many buying opportunities when she moved here. Her 6'10 boyfriend could hardly stand up straight without bumping his head on the popcorn ceiling. Her bed didn't fit him either. Fits me well enough. I told her I was flattered that Scott had phoned me. Suspicious, too. Except for my friendship with Manus, the McKinneys and my family, the Bells, weren't close. Scott tolerated me. His twin daughters, Chloe and Lucy, disliked me. Chloe because I wouldn't fix her speeding tickets. Lucy because I didn't admire her writing as much as she thought I should. Also, there was the Everglades City incident. Well, in any case, Roscoe was a reasonably competent sheriff. What did Scott think I could do that Roscoe didn't? Kim offered me a second drink. I knew she was offering more than that. Oh, going home, I said, and asked her to use her cyber skills to find out what she could about Michelle Glenn. My house is a bungalow at the end of a sandy lane, far enough from the highway that I don't hear the cars and buses going south toward the Keys. My office is the cottage beyond the koi pond. The fish were my mother's hobby, and hearty meals for the predators who inhabit the acres of cabbage palm, banyans, gumbo limbos, and assorted invasives like Brazilian pepper and melaleuca. My mother built the cottage when she decided she'd had enough of my father. She would cook for him, but not share his bed. Bathing wasn't high on his list of priorities. Sleeping next to a man who didn't smell like petroleum products was high on hers. The arrangement was fine with him. He preferred nothing more than solitude after a long day working at Bell Motors. In her opinion, a fancy name for a rural garage, with one other mechanic and a gaggle of customers who drove junkers and rusted pickups. She wondered if his college education was worth it if all he wanted to do was get cancer from chemical substances, COPD from inhaling exhaust, and go deaf from the squeal and roar of motors. Maybe lose a finger to a fan blade? Monday morning, 21st of January, MLK Day and Inauguration Day, Kim had been busy. Glenn was 46 years old. Divorced, she had reserved a room at the villa for the 20th. According to Lola, her daughter, Ms. Glenn had intended to take her time driving there, but she had engine trouble. The shop kept her car longer than she thought it would. She ended up renting one and leaving Austin late Saturday. "From what I could find, adopt a daughter," Kim said. 22 last July. Attends pharmacy school. The Glens live in a modest neighborhood outside of Austin. Miss Glenn clerked at a 7-Eleven. Kim paused to watch a heron stalk across the driveway toward the edge of hibiscus. "However, you'll find this interesting. Glenn used to be a local. Bay Springs, her name was Michelle Gaynor then." "More than interesting," I said. "She has a sister." "Had a sister, Ruth. I found her obit, hit-and-run victim. She's Lola's birth mother." "Oh, news to me. Sad news." I told Kim that Ruth had worked at Hooper's, a gourmet market in Fort Myers that delivered imported cheeses and specialty oils to the villa. One summer day, her van had to be towed to my father's garage. I was 19, she was 20, and very pretty. Stunning, really. Manus offered her a position at the villa, personal assistant, but she turned him down. "You know why?" Kim asked. She understood what Manus was really hiring her for. He never saw a woman he didn't want to sleep with. Well into his 60s, he lived up to his reputation. Cost him a wife and a bundle of money. "Sorry, I missed my chance." "Yeah, where women are concerned, all the McKinneys were the souls of indiscretion way back to Arthur, who squandered a fortune building the villa and giving scandalous parties. During Prohibition, Bill Reed, Roscoe's grandfather, was sheriff. He knew Arthur was buying whiskey from Canada, but no matter how many warrants he got to search the villa, he never found a drop." At noon, Kim and I drove to Mango, an eyesore of trailers, shacks, and stores, and ordered sandwiches at Reba's Deli. Once quite a beauty, Reba is a cancer survivor. She wears a turban, the same shade of green as her polyester slacks. Not easy to find those anymore. My mother was an RN at the county hospital. On weekends, she often helped Reba manage her recovery. Roscoe had just left. "Not a happy camper," she said. "Wanted to kick back and fish in the mangroves, not deal with a fatality at the villa. He figured the victim drank too much, but the ME shot that down. Her blood alcohol level was too low." Reba shook her head. "Roscoe's will have to hang up his rod and reel and earn his salary." She wrapped our sandwiches. I had helped her son win a dispute with the DMV, so she never charged me for the bottles of water I take from the cooler. She's an avid reader of legal thrillers and usually tells me what she's reading. This time, not a word. Just my change and a sly smile. She knows more about what goes on in the county than Roscoe ever will. 75 degrees, blue sky, low humidity. Kim and I start down the path through the sea grape to the picnic tables. In the distance, waves curled on the beach beyond the Australian pines that had survived Hugo and Charlie and other hurricanes whose names I couldn't remember. Music blared, a car stopped in front of the deli, and four people got out, students from somewhere. None looked 21. Well, the only ID Reba pays attention to have numbers and pictures of presidents. The music stayed on. Kim said, "How did the McKinneys make their money?" My father had asked the same question. It perplexed him. The Bells drifted from Virginia prosperity to genteel Florida poverty, while the McKinneys arrived penniless from Ireland and ended up millionaires. Manus said railroads. The McKinneys went from working on them to owning them. The driver emerged from the deli with a six-pack under each arm. Door slammed, the car scattered dust. The music faded. Tell me about the twins. Well, despite weight problem, Chloe was a champion swimmer. Manus gave her a Porsche on her 16th birthday so she could make the county solvent with her speeding fines. She stayed in college 2 years. Strength training dulled her craving for chips and cookies and kept the pounds off. Now she does personal training at the villa, manages its water activities, and drives a Land Rover. Speed limits are only a suggestion. Lucy graduated from Florida State, English major. When she isn't partying with her Miami boyfriend, she checks registration at the villa in case there's a writer or someone in publishing worth meeting. Scott says she's writing a novel, the only literate one in the family. You have any history about her from your law enforcement days? Oh, once, 4 years ago, after we buried Manus, a party, her private wake, she called it, at a falling-down estate near Everglade City. That sounds out of your territory. Oh, it was. Scott didn't like the company she kept. Trust fund dopers and deadbeats? He asked me to check on her. I didn't care for the crowd either, and took her back with me. To the villa? Yeah, eventually. On the walk back to the deli, Kim said, Chloe got a Porsche on her birthday. What did Lucy get? Well, she read a lot. So why not a book? A special one? Dickens' A Christmas Carol, first edition, 1840-something. Cost about what a Porsche did. She wasn't thrilled. She has a temper. She expected time off from school, a Caribbean cruise, 2 months. She survived, the book didn't. I bet she wasn't thrilled when you took her home. She complained she was cold. What was she wearing? A sheet. I left Kim at the office and drove to the villa to talk to Scott. He wasn't there. Dorothy Zell, the assistant manager, said all the McKinneys were at their attorney's office. The twins had turned 25. Oh, I'd forgotten. Their big payday. I asked Dorothy how long she had worked at the villa. Since the hurricane party, she said, October 1989. The villa had been closed most of the summer for major maintenance. Manus and Scott celebrated its reopening with a masquerade ball, invitations only, movers and shakers from across the state. Hugo threatened to spoil things, but attract east toward the Carolinas. Dorothy's husband had been a carpenter and amateur photographer. The framed photographs in the lobby of celebrities who stayed at the villa are his work. He had revealed to me the panel that slid open and led to a corridor where Arthur McKinney hid the whiskey shipped in from Canada for his prohibition parties. Throughout the villa, there are hidden stairs and passageways. Manus used to worry the twins would get lost in one. A sheet? Kim said. We sat on her patio and watched the sunset. Yeah, motels always have clothes people leave behind. One of the maids gave her pants and a shirt. You took Lucy to a motel? Well, I needed to clean her up. What did Daddy say when you brought her home? He noted I was 40, Lucy was 21. The motel didn't have a good reputation. He didn't ask for more details. Someone did. You quit your county job. Oh, I'd already passed the bar exam and didn't intend to keep working for Roscoe. Kim rubbed her chin the way she does when she's concentrating. How does Lucy remember it? The water was warm. Water? Shower. You and Lucy showered together? She wasn't steady enough to manage on her own. The next morning, Roscoe was at the county offices before I was. Something to do with taxes? He said that Lola Glenn was flying in to identify Mrs. Glenn's body. One of Reba's snowbirds hadn't arrived yet. Lola could use the empty trailer. Reba and the Gainers had been friends. At the clerk's office, I requested to see the last will and testament of Manus McKinney, Tracy Button. Mrs. T. Button, manager, on her name tag, mentioned that someone else had asked for a copy the week before. Tracy had been on vacation then. Anyone wanting a copy of a public record has to sign for it and pay a fee. The name scrawled on the signature sheet was hard to read. R something? Matz, maybe? Tracy said. Reba Matz, I said. Herbert Lynn, now retired, had drawn up the original will. His son, also called Herbert, runs the practice now, and Amelia Adams, Herbert's senior longtime assistant, is still in charge. She used to drive a restored 66 Mustang. The motor was small and simple. Oh, my father loved working on it. A 5-minute walk from the county offices to Lynn's office. Amelia greeted me with a kiss on the cheek. She remembered accompanying Herbert Sr. to the villa to read the will. The twins were disappointed with their small bequest of $10,000 each. When they turned 25, however, they would share the asset of a trust still valued at $1 million. She recalled I was also there. Manus had encouraged me to think I might make a decent lawyer. He left me $8,000 to pay my law school debt for the courses I'd been taking on and off for several years and have enough left over to open a law office. The money was also payment to keep my mouth shut. I asked Amelia if either twin had read the will or only heard it read. She recalled that Lucy had requested a copy, and later there had been a tense meeting between Lucy and Herbert Sr. Lucy wanted to add a clarification, something about a comma, as if a punctuation oversight would blow her world up. I assured her the way the will was written was the way her grandfather wanted it done. I knew why Lucy had been upset. I suspected Amelia did, too. I stopped at Reba's for a sandwich. Roscoe was there, having delivered Lola, who was settling into a double-wide behind the deli. Yeah, nice girl, he said, a bit confused. Miss Glenn's dying so far away and all. Any conclusions about that? An accident. Ms. Glenn had driven straight through from Texas, about 19 hours. A bit of wine. She was exhausted. She found a peaceful balcony. Yeah, on the fourth floor? Roscoe shrugged. Someone left the stairway door unlocked. Ms. Glenn probably wasn't paying attention to what floor she was on. She took off her shoes. I interrupted again. Any thoughts about the feather? Yeah, some sort of sex thing? Who knows? Kim dropped a twist of lemon into my glass. When you were out, Lucy stopped by the office and left you an envelope. She was quite cheerful. Well, $500,000 will put a smile on your face. I settled into the chair and sipped my drink. What size envelope? Kim fingered a shape in the air. 8x10, I said. Photographs? Me and Lucy. The motel, a reminder in case I forget. I already told you what happened. I was sure Lucy had made up a much more vivid story, one that would complicate my reputation and career. Not that my office was teeming with clients. I finished my drink. I declined another. Someone I needed to see. Dorothy Zell lives in a cottage on Spar, a barrier island, a 45-minute drive away. 8 o'clock wasn't too late for my visit. I sensed Dorothy expected me. She opened a box of her late husband's photographs. Lots of bright birds and sunsets. Several black and whites of masquerade night. Marie Antoinette was popular. A good excuse to show off your cleavage in a gown that showed off your bank account. Dorothy said, "My Johnny had a real talent for putting people at ease." The trio looked relaxed enough. The Lone Ranger on one side, Tonto on the other, each with an arm around a masked woman dressed like a generic cowgirl, denim jacket, fringe skirt short enough to show off her legs, and dressy boots. The wig of curly hair was more a hippie look. "Manus and Scott," I said. "And Kate, Scott's wife?" "No. Kate wasn't big on parties. Married the wrong man. She was visiting a friend in Alabama. The nanny was minding the twins." Dorothy laid out the photos in a box and closed it. She said, "I saw Curly Locks without her mask. She was alone on the west terrace having a smoke. She looked familiar. She may have worked for one of the villa's vendors. The week after the party, sometimes I'd see her in the service area with Mr. Manus or Mr. Scott. They called her Ruthie. She moved west somewhere." I asked Dorothy if Lucy had ever seen the picture. Probably, since it used to be one of several framed prints in Scott's office. Reba opened at 7. I waited until the early customers had bought their sandwiches and drinks, and the parking lot was empty. She looked up, saw me, and smiled. "You suddenly took an interest in my welfare and need to check on me?" "That was my mother's job. Well, bless her, she did it well." "All the time you spent together, I bet she whispered about your customers or neighbors. Sometimes she told me things that I wished I didn't know. STDs were a local problem." "Your mother didn't whisper, but if she did, what might she have told me?" "Patient information." "I was always sure my lovers were healthy." "No, I mean blood types." "Wow, I wouldn't have paid attention. A, B, O, I get confused. I leave stuff like that to the writers I read. One day, I might pick up something Miss Lucy wrote." "Oh, a crime story?" "Family records. Heavy on sex," Reba said. "What's your blood type?" "Old. You're supposed to laugh." I did, and suggested Lola find out hers, if she didn't already know it. Two swallowtail kites circled in the clear morning sky. I parked in the valet space again. I found Scott in the east garden, smoking his 10 o'clock Panatella. He said, "I order them from Canada. Once we got our Irish whiskey there, now it's Cuban cigars." "I remember your passing around a box of Cohibas after the reading of Manus's will." "Chloe took one, but she never smoked it." "Recently I read the will to find out if I remembered it right." I opened my notebook. "Manus's bequest to Lucy and Chloe begins as follows. I leave $10,000 each to my granddaughters, Chloe and Lucinda O'Brien McKinney." There's a comma between granddaughters and their names. Scott couldn't resist a bit of sarcasm. "Once an English major, always an English major." "Yeah, something like that," I said. "Next, the will refers to the trust to be shared equally by, quote, my granddaughters upon reaching the age of 25 years. I put the notebook away. The granddaughters are named once. The comma between their names creates a non-restrictive clause, which creates a problem. The cash bequests are long gone, but if there were more grandchildren, they could claim a share of the trust, which is not restricted to Lucy and Chloe, who are not named in the trust bequest at all. Scott took a deep breath and studied his cigar. "Go on." "The masquerade, the photograph of you and Ruth Gaynor that used to be in your office. Did Lucy ever ask about it?" "Oh, yeah, she was curious. Who was there, what they wore, what kind of music was played, that sort of thing." "Almost birthday time, number 25, the big one. the trust fund at last. Lucy notices a reservation for a woman named Glenn. 2 nights only? Yeah, that's different. Guests usually book it for a week, or at least the weekend. A bit of web sleuthing, and Lucy finds out Glenn has a mediocre credit history, not the sort of person who usually stays at the villa. How would she even know about the place? Turns out she once lived in the next county. She wasn't Glenn then, she was Gaynor. There was a familial name. Lucy had heard you and Manus talk about Ruth Gaynor. You're right, Lucy is curious and intelligent. She can't even spot a non-restrictive clause. Scott bent over and brushed some dust off his shoe, like he wasn't listening. Punctuation, who cares? Like I was talking to myself. I had more to say. Lucy was on your mind. You had asked me to help her out of a situation before, so you sent for me again. The feather in Mrs. Glenn's luggage, the photo, you in your Tonto outfit, a headband with one tall feather. One and the same. I was meant to conclude that Ms. Glenn had gotten it from Ruth, who had saved it. The masquerade, if Dorothy hadn't brought it up, you would have found a way to do it. The guests gone, you and Ruth together in bed. She keeps the feather as a souvenir. 9 months later, Manus learns a child has been born to Ruth Gaynor, a girl named Lola. Another grandchild? Or, what's your point? My mother was a terrific nurse, also a bit of a snoop. Some of that rubbed off on me. Lucy and Chloe aren't Manus' grandchildren. He's their father. I had Scott's attention now. He opened his mouth, but no words came out. You dated a woman named Kate Mosley. She ran a catering business. That's what she called it anyway. She was pretty and always behind in her bills. When she told you she was pregnant, you married her. The twins were born. No reason to doubt Kate's word that you were the father. Can you prove otherwise? Well, the old-fashioned way, before Double Helix. The county blood bank keeps excellent records. When Kate was really broke, she sold her blood. Type O. Very much in demand. Your boating accident, remember? The propeller slashed your leg. You needed blood. Yours is A. Chloe had her appendix removed. The hospital typed her blood B. Her twin would have had the same. An O mother and an A father can't produce B daughters, but an AB father and an O mother can. When Reba Matz needed blood, Manus volunteered. He and Reba once were close. He was AB. But you knew all that. Scott said, I didn't at first, but my mother did. Kate was one too many of Manus' infatuations that she could tolerate. So she left. Kate wasn't cut out for motherhood. Don't know the financial details, but she agreed to end the marriage and give me custody of the twins. Manus spoiled them and never told them the truth. And now there's Lola, I said. Lucy and Chloe aren't good at sharing. Scott spoke stiffly as if talking to himself. Roscoe was coming down the path when he saw Scott and me. He stopped for a moment as if something bothered him. He shook Scott's hand and said on Sunday one of the housekeepers had mopped up a spill on the third floor by the stairs to the fourth. She mopped the stairs as well and unlocked the door to the residence to make sure she didn't need to mop there. She was in a hurry and might not have locked up. Scott thanked Roscoe for the information, and Roscoe mentioned that Chloe had several unpaid speeding tickets. She was conducting a water aerobics class. Scott promised to remind her that the county wanted its money. While Scott and Roscoe imagined the possibility that Obama might allow the U.S. to import Cuban cigars again, I imagined Ms. Glenn leaving the lobby and Lucy following her. "Ms. Glenn, all the way from Texas, let me give you a tour. Plenty of time. Supper isn't served until 6. Yes, there are hidden halls and stairways, all the way to the 3rd floor. The architect was obsessed with plots and chicanery. The name Jamil means beautiful in Arabic. I'm not supposed to, but I'll take you to 4 and show you the superb view of the Gulf." Roscoe left. Scott and I watched a honeymooning couple photograph each other. Scott pushed himself up. "You've lost weight," I said. He said, "I'd do chemo, but it's pointless, and I'm vain about my hair." Dusk. The birds having their calling around time, Kim and I our drinking time. I said, "Yeah, the trust is sure money. By next week, all the assets of the trust will have been liquidated and the proceeds available to distribute. Scott wants Lola to get her share as long as Chloe and Lucy get theirs. He's dying. His own estate will have substantial debts and obligations. There's the villa. Then there won't be. The Gulf is coming after it. The boathouse is sinking. In time, the water will be up to the highway. When Lucy stopped by with the envelope, she said Chloe is off to the Caribbean, partnering in a new resort. Lucy's going with her." Kim was rubbing her chin again. "The Everglades City incident. Who took those photographs?" "Johnny, a man who worked at the villa." "Why?" "Well, in case down the road Scott needed another favor." "Lucy again?" "Chloe. She spends weekends in the Keys and returns Monday morning, always in a hurry." Roscoe was at his desk, sugaring his morning coffee. His tackle box was on the floor where you could reach it. "I've been expecting you," he said, and opened the folder of incident reports. 0120, 5:45 p.m. Chloe was cited for excessive speed, 25 over the limit, southbound 11 miles from the villa. "Rented Nissan," Roscoe said. "Sundays, no surveillance. Chloe could get into the villa without being noticed." I said, "Monday she would be northbound in her Land Rover, a woman about to inherit $500,000. Roscoe handed me a fax. "Got it late yesterday. The state lab lifted prints off Miss Glenn's belt that didn't match hers, something the county's humble skills and resources couldn't do." "What about Glenn's shoes?" Roscoe pointed to the evidence bag on the credenza. "I kept them to return to Lola." "Miss Glenn stood on a stone bench. Why did she take off her shoes?" "The stairs had been mopped. The soles were damp." "Exactly." I took the shoes out of the bag. "Look new," Roscoe said. I leaned over his desk and slapped the shoes together. Roscoe picked up a pencil and rearranged the bits that had dried on the soles and now were specks on the desktop. "Chips?" "From the hint of color, my guess is the barbecue variety. Retrieving prints from a belt is iffy, but you have a better chance if the person with oily fingers touched the leather." "Miss Glenn, meet my sister. Oh, look, a pod of dolphins. Chloe, put your chips away and help Miss Glenn stand on the bench so she can see them better." Roscoe said, "I sent a deputy to the villa to tell the twins I need to fingerprint them. Standard procedure. They should be here by now." "With their lawyer?" "I believe Hubert Jr. dropped them from his client list." Roscoe slid the tackle box closer, opened it, and took out a lure. He said, "Manus liked you. Have you spent the $8,000? "Nope, not all of it." Roscoe swung the lure back and forth. "He paid part of your college tuition, too, didn't he?" Some, yeah. That's a lot of liking. Manus was generous. You sitting beside Scott reminded me of Manus. Anything you want to tell me? Same gene pool, I said. Your mother, she was an attractive woman, wasn't she? Stop fishing and ask. She and Manus? I pointed to the hooks dangling from the lure. Lucky for you, fish don't know when to keep their mouths shut. We heard the commotion in the hall. The door slammed open. Lucy glared at us and yanked her arm away from the deputy holding hers. Chloe wasn't at the villa. You know where I can find her? Roscoe said. Lucy shook her head. That's your job, not mine. She looked at me. Manus treated you like family, and now you know what your job is. I had planned to start packing for the Caribbean, not being dragged here like a criminal. I had planned a stroll on the beach. You, me, Lola, and Chloe. A discussion of the importance of sharing compared with the expense and complications of investigations and confrontation. Well, you can forget that, I said. Miss McKinney, I wish I could. I prefer a bit of formality when I speak with clients. All right, I've moved on to a different Ellery Queen mystery magazine, their Black Mask Department, a story that was originally published in 1933 by Gilbert King. It's called, He Said It With a Bullet. With a muttered curse and a hard tug on the wheel, I straightened out my car, escaping a yawning ditch by inches, and rove on through the blinding rain. Skidding and lurching from side to side on the water-soaked clay road, I peered through the mud-spattered windshield, hoping that my destination would soon come into view. Oh, finally, when it seemed that I could not drive another mile, the lights of the city appeared in the distance, blinking a welcome to me. A hot bath, a warm meal, a soft bed, and that feeling of peace and contentment that comes after an arduous struggle with the elements beckoned me on, onto a fate that came close to ending my life. Tired, hungry, and with frayed nerves as I was, had I known what awaited me in the city, I would have gladly driven on through the night. All salesmen have their favorite hotels in the various cities and towns which they cover, and as I had been in charge of this territory for over 2 years and knew them all, I drove to the one I always patronized. After parking my car and turning over my bags to a grinning bellboy, I walked into the lobby. As was always my custom, I paused to chat a moment with the girl who presided over the cigar counter. "Well, howdy," I greeted her. "What's the latest scandal?" "Murder," she whispered. "Happened a couple of hours ago." Traveling men know Miss Terry's usual line of small talk and jokes. So I searched her features, expecting her usual wide grin to break forth. But her face remained serious. "No foolin'," she went on. "Steve Hilton shot and killed his wife this afternoon. Gee, I'm sorry for her, and, funny as it sounds, I'm sorry for him, too." "And who is Steve Hilton?" I asked curiously. "And why did he shoot his wife?" "Guess you don't know Steven," she explained. "He runs a little paint shop, and you don't call on the painters. He killed his wife 'cause he found out she was cheating. because she got mixed up with one of you salesmen. Well, he will swing for it, I told her. If they catch him, was her retort. And then she added, I'm glad that it isn't me who has to go after him, because Steve sure has one nasty temper. After buying a package of cigarettes, I left her, went to the desk and registered, then followed the boy carrying my bags to the room to which I had been assigned. As I had not known the Hiltons, I dismissed the tragedy from my mind. In the seclusion of my room, I prepared to take a bath. Opening my travel bag, I took out my toilet articles and a change of linen and turned the water on in the tub. I had just turned the water off and started to step into the tub when a knock came on the door. Calling out to ask who was there brought no answer, so I slipped into my bathrobe and opened the door a crack to see who had knocked. Violently, the door was pushed inward, sending me staggering backward. With great difficulty, I kept my balance and faced a man with a drawn revolver. Quickly, he closed the door behind him, but failed to turn the key. I got you, he snarled, his voice a throaty, husky whisper. Stunned by the suddenness of his appearance and speechless with fright, I looked up at the big man who towered over me. He was hatless, and his bushy black hair was in wild disorder. His gray eyes, narrowed to mere slits, blazed hatred. A thin trickle of blood ran from the corner of his mouth, and his breath came in short gasps. Through his torn brown shirt, I could see his hairy chest rapidly rising and falling with emotion. What do you want? I finally managed to stammer. You, he rasped, you broke up my home. Now I'm gonna kill you. There was a cold menace to his voice that froze my blood in my veins. My tongue clung to the roof of my mouth, holding me inarticulate, and it seemed that I had lost all power of connective thought. I knew that I was face to face with death, but I couldn't think of one thing to do. Desperately, I fought to regain control of my scattered wits, realizing that only fast thinking could save me from being shot down in cold blood. No, I stuttered. Don't shoot. I never did anything to you. I don't know you. I never saw you before. Oh, you're trying to stall, trying to lie out of it? You yellow dog, he spat out vehemently. Please don't shoot, I pleaded as I saw his finger tighten on the trigger of the revolver, saw his knuckles whiten with the pressure. You have the wrong man. I can explain. Explain nothing, he hissed. You can't explain nothing to Steve Hilton. Like a flash came the recollection of the story told me by the girl at the cigar counter a short time before. I was facing a killer, a man who had slain his wife a few hours ago and would not hesitate to shoot me. It did not matter that he was mistaken in my identity, because he was beyond reasoning with, beyond even talking to. I could think of nothing to do but delay him as long as possible in the forlorn hope that help in some form would arrive. Every second I expected his revolver to start pouring lead. I can prove I'm not the man you're after, I shouted. I can shut up, he barked. You drive a blue Chevrolet. You sell soap. I saw the sign on your car when you drove up to the hotel. You can't fool me. You stole my wife, and I'm going to kill you. I drive that kind of car and sell soap, I admitted. But I never knew your wife. Let me prove. You lie, he bellowed. You answer the description of the fellow I'm looking for. You are him. Let me show you some letters. Let me prove that I am not who you think I am, I interceded hopefully. "Your name means nothing to me," came back the unreasoning reply. He took a step nearer me. Frantically, I was trying to ward off what now seemed inevitable. "You will hang if you kill me," I threatened hysterically. "You might have had some justification for killing your wife, and you might get off easy on that, but it'll go hard on you if you murder an innocent man." "So, you're not the right man," he sneered, a crafty look in his eyes. "Yet you know all about my wife and what I did to her. Now I am sure you are the right fellow." His cold, raucous laugh went right through me. I had made a terrible mistake in admitting knowing anything. In desperation, I thought of jumping at him, thought of trying to wrest the revolver from his hand, but I refrained from the attempt, convinced that the slightest aggressive movement on my part would draw immediate fire. I stood motionless at the end of my resources. He seemed in no hurry to shoot now, but showed a disposition to torture me. "You wanted my wife, you fool," he said huskily, "and you got her. I sent her to hell this afternoon. Now I'm going to send you to join her." He hesitated a moment to grin evilly at me, then went on. "There ain't no use of me fooling here anymore. Better get it over with." I knew that the end was near now, and I died a thousand deaths waiting for him to shoot. When he had entered the room, closing the door behind him, he had come forward a few feet into the room. As I stood waiting to die, I glanced behind him at the door. I could hardly believe my eyes. The knob was moving. Fascinated, I watched it slowly turning. Silently, I prayed that the person behind the door would open it in time to save my life. The door opened a crack. Then it squeaked. Hilton heard it. For a split second, his revolver wavered. I could not restrain myself. I cried out. Then came a blinding flash. A hot poker seemed to be drawn across my head, and all was blackness. I came back to consciousness to find myself on the bed in the room and a white-coated ambulance surgeon bending over me. "Just grazed his scalp," I heard him say. "He'll be all right in a few minutes." My first thought was that I was indeed fortunate to be among the living. I tried to sit up, but my head swam, and I had to sink down on the pillow again. The room was full of people. On the floor lay a wounded police officer. They put him upon a stretcher and took him away. A well-dressed young man came over to the bed and sat on the edge. He started to ask a lot of questions after introducing himself as a reporter. I offered to exchange my story for some information as to what happened before and after I was shot. He agreed to do the bargain with a laugh. After I had finished telling him of the events that transpired in the room, he told me that some unknown person had telephoned the police and informed them that they had seen Hilton sneak into the hotel. Immediately, a cordon of officers was thrown around the building, and a search of the premises began. Two officers had been detailed to each floor and ordered to inspect every room. One of the policemen, searching the room on the floor that I was on, overheard Hilton's voice and recognized it. Appreciating my desperate situation, after listening and with the knowledge that he had no time to summon help, he decided to attempt Hilton's capture alone. Knowing that surprise was his best weapon and finding the door unlocked to his amazement, he tried to enter stealthily. The door had squeaked, spoiling his plans. Galvanized into action, the officer rushed in. Hilton, determined to kill me, had deliberately fired at me, but his aim had been ruined by the officer who tackled him. The policeman had lost his balance when he sprang, and before he could regain his feet, Hilton put a bullet in him. Turning to fire at me again, he was rushed by the other policeman who was working on the same floor and overpowered by others who were attracted by the shots. He is now serving a life sentence in a southern prison. The reporter told me also that the man whom Hilton had really wanted to kill had been in the hotel the entire time that the police were searching for Hilton. It was an odd coincidence that he drove the same model car as I drove and also sold soap. There the similarity ended. After an hour's rest, I felt pretty well, so I dressed and went down to the lobby. A crowd was around the cigar counter. Miss Terry saw me get off the elevator and called me over. As I approached, she shouted, "Here comes the hero. Now we will hear the story firsthand." "You know as much as I do about it, old Eagle Eye," I chided her. "You miss nothing." "Right," she laughed. "But you have the nerve to call me old Eagle Eye? It's a good thing for you that I do notice things that happen at this place. My old Eagle Eye spotted Hilton sneaking in on the back way, and I called the police. If I had not, you would be dead now. You owe me a life, big boy, and I like chocolates." She got a 5-pound box. All right, my friends, that's going to do it for the Mystery Hour this time. Keith Tyler here saying thank you so much for tuning into this show and the Sun Sounds of Arizona. Join me again next time, would you please? Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.